maybe you could talk a little bit about one of the issues that you and I have talked about over a long period of time is the whole issue of child support and child support collections. Maybe talk a little bit about your role in the child support process and how you've been working to make that both more effective for the state but more effective for people so that child support doesn't become a real impediment to a better life.
It's one of the things that we've talked about before in various settings. And for us, it was I'll start off with bragging a little bit, right? In the last 2 years, we've collected more child support in the history of this than any time in the history of the state. We're up $37 million from just about 2 years ago. So big increase, well over $500 million being collected. Now, when that happened, the Baltimore Sun did a nice story about child support increases. And I got a call from someone high within the government who said, oh, that's great. You know, you're really cracking down on those deadbeat dads. And I said, well, that's true. There are folks who can afford to pay that don't. But what I have a lot more of, folks who would like to pay but can't afford to. So we actually, and we've had this conversation before, we actually got the University of Maryland to take a look at that and do a statistical analysis. So there was a woman named Letitia Logan Passarella who did a fantastic analysis for us and gave us some information that confirms what we long suspected, right? We have deadbeat dads, but we have a lot more dead broke dads. And a system that treats every one of those the same is only going to be so successful. So for those dead broke dads, the ones who would pay if they had the ability to pay, we have to approach it in a different way. So for us, looking at, without going too deep into the numbers, give you some of the high level numbers. 44% of our cases, right, they pay 75% or more of child support, right, which is great. 35% pay 0 to 25%. Of what their child support order is. So we looked in particular at those folks about what are the characteristics of those folks and why don't they pay.
And the implications of that in Maryland are pretty profound. They don't have a driver's license. They're going to get their wage garnished. They're going to have a bank account.
Yeah, absolutely. What we found was those folks, they don't have jobs. Right. So if you look at the number, the percentage of them that were actually employed at any time during the year that we looked at, 15% had employment in any quarter. Only 3% of them had employment for all four quarters, right? So if you look at those folks, they have child support orders that are put in by a judge. Those child support orders are equal to between about 68 and 76% of their annual income. So think about that, right? You have no job, right? You have very little money coming in, and you have this child support order, right, that is up there that's two-thirds to three-quarters of your income. How are you going to pay that? You can be very discouraged very quickly. Right. And if you look at those folks, right, they have trouble paying. They don't pay. And they account for all the arrears that we have in child support across the state. We have $1.3 billion in child support arrears owed across the state. The folks who are in that I don't have a job, but I have a big child support order category. They are 65% of the arrears. So we have $1.3 billion in arrears. So about $800 million of the arrears that are owed in child support are to these dads. They're largely dads. 90% of them are dads. These non-custodial parents who don't have jobs, right? So there's a school of thought out there that I should suspend their license. I should take things and try to force them to pay. But if for example, if you're a non-custodial parent who's got a barber's license, right, and that's the way you know to make money, right, but you can't find a job, right, there are folks out there who want me to suspend the barber's license and say you don't get your barber's license back until you start to pay.
Well, in Maryland, isn't that the case?
That is the law here to do it, and we have some discretion, right? But to me, if I'm doing that, why would I take away his one ability, the ability he has or the best way he has to make money? Why would I take that away if I want him to start paying, right? So, you know, or revoke his driver's license so he can't get to work. So for us, we think for those folks, the ones who would pay if they could, that we want to approach them, we want to work with them, we want to help them get job training, we want to help them get jobs so that they can start paying child support. And the other piece of this is when they start paying child support, it's much easier for those dads to be part of their child's life.
Yeah, right? This is why it's been so great to work with you and the Center for Urban Families, because those are incredibly complementary positions.
And if you think about it, we have a program called NPEP, and we have some things we're doing with the Center for Urban Families, the non-custodial employment program. We've actually managed to disperse $22 million in child support from folks who we've helped find jobs, right? That's a 22% increase over what we did before, just 2 years ago. And in addition to that, right, a lot of times if families aren't getting child support, they may be getting TANF, or what a lot of people consider, welfare, right? We have avoided through the non-custodial employment program, we've avoided over $155 million in TANF payments.
Let's make the case for our listeners, because I think it's a really important distinction between the kind of child support that you and I are talking about, which is money that's owed to the state mm-hmm. to essentially reimburse the state for welfare payments to the mm-hmm. mom, and child support that's paid as a condition of alimony or a traditional divorce.
Right. So most of the cases that we have, there are a lot of child support cases in the state that have nothing to do with the department. Right. So folks who have more means and able to work it out on their own, those child support cases don't go through the department at all. Our cases are a category of cases called 4D cases, which is just a government acronym. But they're generally folks with lower incomes and they have contested cases. So for us, a lot of times, if, say, a mom's got a child, dad's not paying child support, they will, we will give them a TANF payment or a welfare payment. They sign over the child support rights to us, right? Which means that if we're paying welfare and then we are able to get dad to start paying child support, we then reimburse the taxpayer's cost of providing that welfare, and then the child support payments come in. So a lot of the arrears we have are they're TANF cases where literally the state is on the hook for the welfare payments and waiting to get the child support collected. And then we have to reimburse ourselves and the federal government, who pays a portion of it too, before we can get that child support arrangement put together.
Right. It's a really important distinction. And one, when you and I go around and talk about this, a number of moms come after us and make the point that we're letting fathers off the hook and the mother isn't getting the money. But in this instance, the mother isn't getting the money whether the guy mm-hmm. doesn't pay or whether he does pay, because the money's going to reimburse the state for money that the mother already got.
Right. And I think that my response would be to a mother who said that is, the best thing we can do for you is to get dad employed, get him a job so that he can make payment. Because time and time again, you see, we have plenty of folks who make their child support payments, right? It's a question of affordability. It's a question of getting that order to be something that is reasonable. And it's having steady employment for the non-custodial parent so they can make those payments on time. And most non-custodial parents will make those payments if they have the resources. Now, do I have folks that I've had to go after with every bullet I have in the chamber? Oh, yeah. I had a guy who had over $1 million in the bank, moved to another state, owed $395,000 in child support. We used every trick in the book to get that money. I had a gentleman who worked for the NFL. He had his passport revoked and needed to leave the country as part of his job. He didn't get to leave until he paid his child support. Now, in those situations, we will not hesitate to do absolutely everything we can to do that. But part of what I think we do wrong a lot is, especially a social service agency, we say one size fits all. We're going to do the same thing for everybody, because I think it's rooted in the idea of fairness, that we have to be fair by treating everybody exactly the same. To me, I'm much more interested in, and this might be my business background, is what's effective. Right. And for us, the most effective thing is helping those folks get jobs so they can pay. Right. So if we can have a system that's nimble enough to understand deadbeat dad, I'm going to go after him with everything I have. But ones who are dead broke, I'm going to take a different approach. To me, as long as it results in dad paying child support and the kid getting what he needs, I'm much more interested in that result than how I get there.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why I've been so impressed with your work is that you get the fact that all of these social ills are connected, that if a man can't have a driver's account, driver's license, he's going to have his income garnished, and he can't have a bank account. And somebody like Maximus, who's collecting this stuff, is after him all the time. He's probably going to go back to some cases in selling drugs, then get mm-hmm. locked up. So the scourge of the drug trade, to some extent, is linked to our child support collection policies mm-hmm. on these dead broke dads. It'll be very interesting to see if this cohort of dads has a lower recidivism rate mm-hmm. than the rest of the group.
And I'll do you one better than that, is if you think about the problems it can cause between the custodial parent and the non-custodial parent when child support's not being paid, a lot of times that results in lack of involvement in raising the child. Right. And most kids will do better if they have both parents involved in their lives. So you have some of these arrears and these things that, from child support orders that are too high to not being employed, that it's getting in the way of that child benefiting from both parents. So if we can do that, not only does it make sense from the fiscal side for us in terms of avoided welfare payments and all those things, but think about that child. That child is now able to have both parents in their lives, and they get the benefit of both parents. And that can make all the difference for a kid, particularly ones who come from low-income areas who are the folks that we serve in majority.
It's a great social outcome for everybody. It really is. So you've got to be pretty proud of that accomplishment. What else have you done at DHR that you feel particularly good about?
Oh, you want me to brag about DHR a little bit? I think I could probably do that. We have, over the last 2 years, we've set records for the most people moved from welfare to work in any time in the state's history. It's, I think, a 16% increase. And for us, we're very happy about the fact that almost 40% of those, I think it's 37% of them, have gotten jobs that pay more than $10 an hour. That's particularly important to us because if they get a job that pays more than $10 an hour, they're 80% less likely to come back to us within 6 months having lost a job or needing welfare again. So really moving those people to self-sufficiency, that has been a fantastic thing for us, and really working to get people into that area and getting to a place where they can become self-sufficient. They just don't need us anymore.
How have you made DHR a metrics-driven culture? Because the things that you're talking about really are all based on having data to prove your assertions that this leads to that.
Well, three things, I think. First one is if you work in the O'Malley administration, you're doing that by default. The governor is a big believer in that, the whole state stat process. It is a focus that he has led from the top and has gone to almost every agency. The second thing is I think it's the way my mind works. It helps me understand things, and I think it also helps us be able to talk about the results that we've had. And finally, we've been able to reduce the number of kids served in the child welfare system. We have the lowest number of kids in the child welfare system at any time in the last 26 years. Over the last 6 years or so, DHR's has moved over 17,000 kids to permanence. That's adoption, guardianship, or reunification for their family. And for us, it's about kids growing up in their homes. That's where they do best. They don't grow up well in institutions. So there's a real sea change in the department where we're serving kids in their home where we can, and it's better outcomes for kids. And the number of kids that are actually in the system that are exposed to the trauma of being taken out of their home is at an all-time low in the state.
That's wonderful. How have you one last question. On the subject of getting kids permanent placements, how have you done that?
That, I think, is a bunch of things, right? I think the first thing is you need to get a team of people around to understand that particular kid. I mentioned earlier, one size doesn't fit all. You don't treat every kid exactly the same way. You develop an individualized plan for that kid. You look at the resources that are available. The first choice by federal law, they encourage us to look at reunification. But if that doesn't work, strengthening our adoption services, looking at guardianship, looking at kin placements, looking at other places where a kid can have a normal life. They can grow up, they can go to school, they have friends, they're not living in group homes for years and years and years. Those are the things that I think lead to permanency and lead to placement. We've had record numbers of adoptions over the last couple of years too. All those things, getting those kids into a family setting, that's the difference for us.
That's fabulous.